This is Red Ice Radio, a beacon of sanity from Northern Europe. RedIceCreations.com.
Welcome to Red Ice Radio, new and regular listeners. This is Henrik Palm here. Very nice of you to tune in today. It's great to know that you have an explorative mind and that you indeed are interested in learning new things. This program is a searchlight in the darkness, an effort to shine a big, bright light on many of the things that most people never even knew existed. In other words, all the important stuff. You know what I'm talking about. If you don't, you can find out more and follow us on a regular basis at RedIceCreations.com. Today we're talking with Shannon Dory. She is the author of a series of three books about the Numo, the fish people, or the merfolk, those who came to Earth a long time ago from another star system. Her work also goes into the mythology of the Dogon people, who in their religion talk about these fish or serpent-looking hermaphrodites. Dory is a graduate of Trent University in Peterborough, Ontario, where she studied English, history, and mythology. Her interests were expanded into religious studies after studying the New Testament at the University of Windsor in 1991. She began her writing career as a journalist and still continues writing articles for various online publications. Stay with us as we talk about the Numo's voyage to Earth, why they came here, their knowledge of genetic engineering, how the story of these amphibious aliens appear all over the ancient world, and what role the Dogon people has in all of this. Thank you so much for coming on. This is going to be a really interesting program, since this is a topic I've been interested in for a long time now, the Dogon, and obviously the Numo, and so much more that is connected with this, and we'll definitely get into it in some detail. You have three books behind you, as I've mentioned, and obviously we're going to talk about the latest one primarily here today, The Day of the Fish, but obviously it would be a good idea to go through some of the background of the whole story, so to speak. But first of all, Shannon, just tell us what have driven you throughout the years of studying the Dogon. What was the main drive? Because as I you know, reading your books, in the beginning you couldn't grasp obviously all the concept of the Dogon, and this is kind of a story that you pieced together. So what right. has been keeping you going, so to speak, throughout the years, Shannon?
Well, the main thing that's kept me going is that I realize how important this mythology is to the world. It was when the anthropologists Marcel Griol and Germaine Dieterlin began recording the religion in the 1930s, the Dogon tribe are one of the last people in Africa to come under French rule. And prior to that time, they had maintained their own beliefs and religious practices. They were living in an oral culture, and their traditions were foreign to anything known to the world at that time. Marcel Griol deemed them to be the most backward race in the whole region and the best example of primitive savagery known to the world at that time. He writes that Muslim Africans couldn't understand the Dogon religion any better than the Europeans could. Now, in their religion, they talk about amphibious, serpent-like beings who are associated with both the Pleiades and the Sirius star systems. And these beings were identified with the sacred feminine. And my research shows that these were the goddesses that were worshipped and revered by the people of old Europe. And I refer to Maria Gimbutas's research on the goddess because many of the symbols that she associates with the goddess religion of old Europe are the same symbols that the Dogon people associate with the Numo. I believe that this religion is the pagan mystery religion that was thought to have been lost to humanity, that was talked about by the Egyptians, Greeks, Romans, Celts, and others. And the Dogon people were very protective of this religion. They fled their homeland of Mande, west of Bamako, sometime between the 10th and 13th centuries because they refused to convert to Islam. And even when Marcel Griol lived amongst them, he lived with them for 15 years, they never let him in on the innermost secret teachings of the religion until 1946. And I believe the only reason they did this was because they'd had several run-ins with the French authorities, and they probably realized it was only a matter of time before they would be prevented from practicing their religion. So they had the Dogon elder, Ogutemali, who was considered one of the most intelligent people on the cliffs of Bandiagara, where the Dogon lived at that time. And he taught the religion to Marcel Griaul, who recorded it in 1946. It took 33 days of meeting with Ogutomelli. Now, Ogutomelli had taken over 20 years himself to learn this religion. He had learned it from his father and his grandfather, so that gives you some idea of how complex it was.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, he lived in an oral culture, so this was all memory work. And I think this is one of the reasons why it's so hard for researchers to understand this religion, because it does come from the very beginning of known history. And it came from an oral culture. Now, we live in a written culture, so we look at literature as, you know, it has a beginning and then it has an end. But this isn't how this religion is constructed. It's based on symbols that are related to each other. So it sort of forms a ball. And I believe it's a metaphor for immortality, because the Numo were considered to be immortal beings. Ogutomelli described them as being like serpents who, when they died, they shed their skin and they could remember from one lifetime to the next. So this religion is very important, and I don't think it's gotten enough attention. I think part of the reason it hasn't is because Marcel Griaul lived in a patriarchal culture himself, and he referred to the Numo as gods of water, and they were clearly associated with the sacred feminine. They were identified with the sun, which was a female symbol in the Dogon religion. And so he identifies these beings as male, and he also identified the seventh ancestor, whom my first book is written about, as the master of speech, when in fact she should have been identified as the mistress of speech. He even refers to her in the back of his book, Gods of Water, that she was a female being, but throughout the book he calls her he. And, you know, we have to realize that he did live in a very patriarchal culture. Women at that time had no power, and maybe he did this on purpose so that the religion would get some attention. It's hard to say. But it probably has thrown off a lot of researchers, because people like Maria Gimbutas would have loved to have had something like this when she was doing her research. And the same with Joseph Campbell. He would have understood this religion probably, because he was very good at understanding symbols.
Exactly. So, you have obviously, by the way, so a really good outcrop, if I can put it that way, from Joseph Campbell pertaining to how also this might have been reversed, known as solarization.
Right.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, many of the symbols from the goddess religion, that they were still identified with the female in the Dogon religion. Joseph Campbell talks about how the warring tribes, whose traditions have come down to us in Christianity, Judaism, the Greek and Roman myths, and these patriarchal warring tribes didn't like the fact that the female was the deity in these religions, so they reversed all the symbols of the earlier religion, and the female loses her androgynous status, because these beings were hermaphrodites. They were self-fertilizing hermaphrodites, and I believe that's where the myth you get of the virgin goddess in biblical and Greek mythology. So he reverses these symbols, and when he does so, you lose this whole, patriarchal tribes reverse these symbols, so you lose the whole concept of androgynous goddesses, and they become females relegated to the negative symbol in the religion, which was the moon, and the sun was the more important symbol. So Joseph Campbell identifies this as the birth of the Sun King, and he says how then the symbols all become confused because of this reversal. But this never happened in the Dogon religion. These symbols, so I believe it is the purest form of this religion, because they were still identified with the female at that time.
Very interesting. And also, of course, something that you touched upon is the possibility of falsification, intentional falsification of history, of turning religions on their end and for various reasons and purposes. What do you think is the case here when it comes to the Dogon? Because as you point out in the book as well, they were closed off because of their, I think, location, right, primarily, and,
right,
and they weren't
yeah.
really encroached upon until the 1930s or 20s, right?
Yeah, 30s, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that means that potentially the propagandists of, around the world basically hadn't they didn't know about them. They hadn't gotten a chance to get their long tentacles all the way there, basically.
Yes, that's right. The a lot of it, I believe this religion was practiced all over the world at one time, and I certainly have found many traces of it in Europe. In fact, I believe it was still being practiced right up until the witch trials in the Middle Ages. I think that perhaps the center of it might have been in the south of France with the Cathars. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Albigeois.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So what happens is the Roman Catholic Church attacks this area, which was, you know, a very developed area in Europe at that time. It was considered the intellectual center of Europe. These individuals that lived in the south of France, they ran paper mills and this kind of thing. So the Catholic Church was thought that they were getting too powerful, so they had one of the Crusades attack the south of France. And this was considered one of the first genocides of a people in modern times. And there's one story where they talk about how one of the soldiers ran up to the papal legate and he said, "What do we do? There's Christians in amongst the Cathars in the church. And, you know, what are we going to do?" And he said, "Burn them all. God will recognize his own." So we have these people that are destroyed, but they were wealthy, and some of them did escape. And they ended up in places like England and Scotland. In fact, Harold Bailey talks about this in his book, how one of the first paper mills in Glasgow was created by some of these refugees that had fled France. And this was the beginning of this wave of terror where this religion was wiped out. But the interesting thing about the Cathars or the Albigensians, however you refer to these people, they did get involved in paper making. And many of the symbols that they, in the form of watermarks that they put in the paper for printing popular literature of the era, were the symbols of their religion. And Harold Bailey's book talks about all these different symbols that, and I actually found your, I saw your video on your site about the Illuminati and how you were mentioning the symbols appearing in movies and things like that. And
right,
it reminded me of this, of these symbols that these people had put in their literature in the form of watermarks to, you know, to keep their religion going.
Yeah.
And apparently this went on for several centuries. So
it's a very very interesting connection here, in other words, and we have a transferring or this obviously religion or tradition, if you will, have spread again across the globe. But do you think at the time though it was just limited to being kept in northern Africa where the Dogon were, or has this always been spots, if you will, around the planet where it has existed? What do you think?
I think it's always been around the planet. I think it's just hasn't survived anywhere else. And when you look at what's happened through our history and the things that have gone on, excuse me, with the Inquisition and the Crusades and things of that nature, it's surprising that this religion has survived at all.
Yeah, that's right.
So
well,
yes.
It has been a slaughter in that sense, obviously. But why do you? I always go back to this idea. Why is that? What is so dangerous with this specific tradition? And this can be supplanted to many cultures, of course. And it could simply be because all of these ancient native, if you will, cultures have had an essence of this that we're going to get into in some detail. But why do you think it has been such a threat to the powers that be that have been trying to eradicate it throughout the millennia now?
Well, of course, part of the problem is that they were alien beings, and they were feminine beings, and we live in a patriarchal world. The Christian church definitely would not want it known that feminine figures were responsible for human creation, which is what the Dogon tell us. So, it undermines their power. So I believe that was the main reason that this happened, because these cultures were powerful at that time in history, and it just started. And I mean, how do you change people's thinking now? I mean, it's an incredible truth that people don't want to hear.
Yeah, I know it's and you also very well pointed out in the book that excuse me, when it comes to the Dogon, theirs is an oral culture tradition where things are spread orally, and today, of course, we have, as you pointed out, it's a literal in that sense history or by writing, and even further beyond that, now we have a digital storytelling, and I think that this is a really good point, and maybe just for a moment we can talk about that, because what that means in one way is that if someone would to analyze, if you will, what we left behind in the digital archives, if you will, it would be very difficult to determine what was essential or important in the culture. Therefore, very very little from their point of view would actually be important, right? Tell us about that.
Yes, one of the passages they use in the when they're talking about the Dogon religion is that I'm not sure if I'm quoting exactly, but when the crop is light and thin, it's full of breeze and full of sound. But when the crop is heavy, it's weighed down by the wind and bows itself in silence.
Yeah.
And what they're saying here is that the Dogon culture is a very because it was an oral culture, only the most important information is passed down because it's memory work. They have to memorize this in order to pass it on from person to person. So they did have techniques to help them with memorization, like antithesis was one, just the phrase that I just told you, where you have the heavy crop in comparison to the light crop. So that this was a way that helped them to remember things. But when you get to the written culture, even in Griol's day, Europe was a written culture. You know, you have so much information. Well, how do you determine what is important in that culture? And the same with today, where I mentioned that, you know, people put trivial details on their Facebook pages, and everything that people write about is recorded in the digital age. So how do you sift through that and say, well, is this what's important and what isn't important? So this is another reason why I believe this religion is so important, because it was passed down through all these years.
Absolutely. We'll get into it in detail here. But first of all, the book Conversations with Ogotemali, is that one of the first works you came across when it comes to the Dogon?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I'm just learning to speak French, and of course this is all recorded in French, so that was the first English translation, and fortunately it is the most important of his works because it was the one that was recorded in 1946 when they finally agreed to let him into the innermost teachings, and it is the one that presents the symbols of the religion.
Exactly, and that's why this is so interesting. Marcel Griol, he, as far as I understand, then didn't have an understanding of the religion per se. He just he went to the extent of just detailing it, right, and didn't do that much interpretation of it, correct?
Yes, that's right. And part of the reason he didn't understand, and it's probably a blessing for us that he didn't, because he wasn't able to. I mean, as I mentioned earlier, he identified these figures as being male. And if he had understood the symbolism, he might have changed the symbolism as well. But we have the symbols to reinforce the fact that these are female beings because they were associated with the sun, which was the female symbol. So,
absolutely. But why don't we then, Shannon, kind of go into some of the basics of the Dogon religion? Maybe you can deconstruct it for people who never have heard about this before, and then at the next step, I guess we could tie in the pneumo and everything else here. But run through some of the basics for us first, Shannon.
Well, according to the Dogon, the pneumo first came to Earth because their own world was dying, and they were initially associated with the Sirius star system. And they believe that when they came here that there wasn't any intelligent life on the planet. And they as I mentioned, they were immortal beings, and they did have the ability to create life. They were familiar with biological engineering, so they believed that they could create a new life on the Earth that they could move their souls into and live on the Earth. And in, as I mentioned, they were amphibious beings, and in my first book, The Master's Speech, I relate, associate them with the killifish, which is a fish found in Florida on Earth. And these fish are also self-fertilizing amphibians like the Pneumoer. And in 85% of the time, they're self-fertilizing beings, but and they're born as females, first of all, and then they develop testes later in life, and not to several years or something like that. And 15% of the time, single-sex males are born. And these males are, the researchers believe, were to provide genetic diversity to the species. And I believe the Pneumo procreated much like this, because they talk about the experiment, and the first beings are born self-fertilized and more like the Pneumo. But when one of these single-sex males is born, who, if we compare it to the killifish, are born periodically to provide this genetic diversity in this species, they realized that the experiment had failed because this male was totally severed from the Pneumo's spiritual essence. He was a mortal being, and he has no memory of having lived before. Essentially, he signifies humans, even though in the religion he is identified as a male, because the Pneumo were identified as being female beings. So he is identified as the jackal, mm-hmm. in the Dogon religion.
Yeah.
And we see this in old Europe too, where the dog is a symbol of harbinger of death, and this is what the jackal represents in the Dogon religion. Now, according to the mythology, it's not specific whether it's just him or other males like him. In some passages, it suggests that it could have been a group of them who were born this way, who couldn't connect with the Pneumo. And Oga Tomali describes it as that the jackal was alone from birth, and because of this, he did more things than can be told. And one of the things he does is he steals one of the Pneumo spaceships and ends up crashing it into the Earth, creating a worldwide devastation that forces the survivors to flee, and they head to the Pleiades star system. And it's the Pleiades is associated with the second experiment, which they mention it happening on Earth. So there's some suggestion that they do come back here to create the second experiment. And what they do is they take the DNA from the first two individuals that were born, and they combine it to create eight beings that are known to the Dogon people as the eight ancestors. And these ancestors are then taken to the Pneumo's world to live. But because of the defect that had occurred in the first experiment, the Pneumo are very nervous about allowing these individuals to breed freely. Procreation is controlled, and the first ancestor can only breed with the eighth, and the second with the seventh. And the reason being with the second and the seventh is that the seventh ancestor, who is the who Griol identifies as the master of speech, who I refer to as now as the mistress of speech, is the seventh ancestor, and she's considered to be the only one of the ancestors who has the perfect combination of Pneumo and human DNA. And she is only allowed to breed with the second ancestor because this ancestor is considered to be most like genetic makeup that's like the jackal. So these two are put together, the good is put with the bad, so to speak. And then the third and fourth ancestor are allowed to breed in the fifth and fourth. At any rate, everything's fine on the Pneumo's world until the first and second ancestor, who, incidentally, the first four ancestors are identified as males and the last four ancestors are identified as females.
Mm-hmm.
And these first two ancestors, even though they're primarily male beings, these individuals are all hermaphrodites. And one of them, they suggest in the mythology that one of them becomes pregnant. And this would have been a very terrible thing for the Numo, because they felt their own immortality was threatened by this. And Ogutmali doesn't really say, he wasn't sure whether they got kicked out of the Numo's world or whether they left in anger from the Numo's world, but at any rate, all eight ancestors end up back on Earth. And I believe that just because of other world mythology that I've studied in association with this one, is that they fled the Numo's world because they were afraid that they may have had to abort this child. And all the ancestors come with them. And when they come back to Earth, the Earth is still devastated. And they talk about flooding the Earth and cleaning the soil with some kind of liquid. And and they bring the DNA from the Numo's world to be reproduced on Earth. And they teach, there's some humans that have survived the flooding that they do to clean the Earth. And they teach agriculture to those surviving humans. And so that's basically, and then, when they do come back because of this child, you see, I think this is why they had to create the third experiment when Lebe is created. Because Lebe, this is the third experiment and identified with the third word in the Dogon religion. Each experiment is associated with the word as a symbol. And Lebe is considered a combination between the seventh and eighth ancestors, who are two females. So she has the exact opposite genetic makeup to the child of the first two ancestors. So even though the child isn't mentioned, I believe the child must have been born on Earth, and that's why Lebe had to be created to offset the genetic mistake from the birth of this child.
Huh. And yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, and as a result of Lebe's birth, some of the Numo's DNA is removed from humanity, and humans are turned into single-sex beings in the hope that they will eventually evolve back into immortal and androgynous beings, because they associate immortality with androgyny and hermaphroditism.
It's a fascinating story, and there's so many things here I want to obviously, you know, dissect and go into in detail about,
sure.
Because some of these things are now corroborated in modern scientific knowledge. We'll get into that. But first of all, how is this story told in the Dagon tradition? Is it symbolic, and then this has been interpreted by, you know, translators, and then finally you? Or how does the story come down? Does it come down in this vivid kind of way that you're describing it now?
No. They record the religion. Marcel Griol records it as Ogutmali tells it to him. Yes, he does. Some of what I'm telling you is recorded in it. A lot of it is symbolism. There's various symbols, and you have to understand the symbolism in order to understand what the story is really telling you. And the way you determine the symbolism is by looking at all the various stories and realizing what the symbol means in this particular story, and then you can use it in the next story, and you see how they're related. You have to study the religion. It's not something you can pick up and read in an hour and hope to understand it. It's a very involved study, and sadly, I don't think this mythology has been given enough attention by scholars around the world.
There's a lot here, and obviously already I think some of our listeners as well will recognize the story that you told us being echoed in other cultures and traditions around the world. Obviously the whole story of the flood, it's right there, mm-hmm. but also even the story of the Anunnaki, if you will, or the Nephilim. How have you compared their tradition, their story, to others around the planet, Shannon?
Well, the Day of the Fish is primarily showing the traditions, how they related to old Europe, and I mostly talk about the symbols that Maria Gimbutas associates with the goddess religion, because that's primarily what this religion is. And I talk about some of the artifacts that appear in old Europe, like the frog and the salamander, amphibious figures that I believe represent the Numo. The Numo were carved with these very long necks, and of course these long necks appear in many of these ancient sculptures dating back, 6,000 BCE. We have the round mouth, which is a very common symbol in the goddess artifacts. And this also appears in Dogon carvings. In the Dogon religion, it represented a full moon, which was supposed to be beneficial to humans because the Numo were supposed to return on the day of a full moon. So you have a lot of these symbols in Europe. You also have one of the descriptions they talk about, the master of speech, who I identify with the mistress of speech, is sacrificed in the religion, and her DNA is used in the creation of Lebe, and they describe this process where her umbilical cord is planted, and it grows into this tree called the Kalena tree, and then she's tied to this tree, and then wrapped around with this metallic iron spiral, and when she's sacrificed, her blood it feeds this plant that forms on the tree and it looks like mistletoe growing on an oak tree. So all through Europe you have these mistletoe being associated with regeneration, which is what it was in the Dogon religion. It was a purification of humanity by this sacrifice. And after this process, this figure is then struck in the forehead with a bolt of lightning from the Numo spaceship. And women in the Dogon society would wear this strap around their head to show the place on their forehead where the master's speech had been hit with this bolt that went through her body and her spine, and then her blood falls into this copper bowl that creates these stones, and then we have the creation of Lebe using these stones to mark her pelvis and her arms and this kind of thing. And this is all described in the Dogon religion.
Fascinating.
I was just going to say that in Europe too, they believe that mistletoe came to earth when a tree was hit with a magical bolt of lightning. Huh. So you see these same themes appearing in Europe.
Absolutely, and I want to ask you about some of these. How about just the echoes of the Egyptian religion with, for instance, you mentioned the jackal, obvious association, Anubis, the god of afterlife, or even death in that case, a total match. And then we have Sekhmet, the lion goddess, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the things that I talk about in the book is I trace the Madonna images through Ur, starting in Ur, which the reason I first discovered these sculptures, because they look very much the way Ogutamala described the Numo. The Numo had webbed hands. They were primarily water beings. And they had these round bumps that appear on their fingers that the Dogon women would wear rings to mimic these. Ogutamala says, all that adorns the spirit of water also adorns women, because they were female beings. So you see the characteristics of the Numo being mimicked in the jewelry of the women. And these round circular bumps also appeared on the elbows and wrists of these beings. And so the women would wear copper bands around their elbows and wrists to mimic these bumps. And these earth statues have these bumps on them. And they also have horns on their heads, or casks. And Ogutamala referred to the fact that the Numo had horns or casks. They were identified with chameleons, and he identified how the Numo's horn fits into its hood, into their hood, in the same way that a corn of stalk fits into its husk. And so I use these Ur figurines in the book because I believe they're very much like how Ogutamala described these beings. They also had lines on their abdomens, which these statues have. And they're Madonna figurines, and this is the earliest image of the Madonna, and some of them date back to 6,000 BCE. And, of course, the Numa were the creators, the mothers of the earth, so to speak. And then we follow this Madonna image, and we see it appearing in Mesoamerica culture, where the Madonna is shown with an elongated head, and the Numa also had elongated heads. But she is shown with two legs, and she dates from 300 BC to 300 AD, so she's a much later version of this Madonna. But the babies has a lizard-shaped head, and the Madonna, the Ur-Madonna babies all have lizard-shaped heads, and that was another way that Olga Tamala described these beings as lizards. And the figure of Isis with the Horus child is another Madonna image, and she's shown with the disc between her horns, and this is a very important image in the Dogon religion, because the Numa were, as I mentioned, had horns, but when they were in their spaceships, the spaceships were a truncated pyramid, but they had a round base to them. So when they were in the sky, they looked like this big round red. They call it a calabash, which is a type of vegetable, but it looks like a sun. It's red. And then it had this tubing curling around the top of the craft, which Olga Tamali said held either copper or he called it liquid copper or water. And this tubing looked like the horns of a ram. So when they were in their spaceships, they were viewed as celestial rams. And the horns that we see on Isis, I believe, are the same. The cow was a symbol of the Numa in the Dogon religion, and Isis was known as the cow of heaven in Egyptian mythology. And in the Dogon religion, the name Ne meant sun, and that was a symbol of the spaceship and the Numa, because it was a female symbol, and it also meant mother. A close version of it, Ne meant mother, and Na or something like that meant cow. So they were very closely related in the Dogon religion, and of course we see this with Isis, and we also see her as the Madonna image with the child Horus in Egyptian mythology.
That's right. It's very interesting to see how this symbol has transformed, if you will, and gotten different interpretations probably throughout the years. How fish-like do you think that they actually were? I mean, is this where we get the mythology of the mermaid, for instance, from? But there's a number of these sea gods, if you will, that we can get into, like Oannes, and actually even people like John the Baptist have both a etymological connection, but also a symbolic connection to this as well.
Yes, the Numa themselves looked, according to Olga Tamali, they were more like lizard figurines. They looked like serpents when they walked on land. They only had a fish tail, but it was considered to be the right leg. Everything associated with the Numa always appeared on the right side of the sanctuary. And so Dogon women would wear a copper ring around their right ankle, and this represented the leg of the Numa, so to speak, their fish tail. And apparently the Numa had this ring around the end of their tails as well. And the eight ancestors also had fish tails, but they were more human-like. But they had Olga Tamali refers to them as having wide open eyes, like bulging eyes type thing. And in my book, I associate with them the image of the Gorgon from Greek mythology, an image that goes back about 6,000 BCE. And Maria Gimbutas associated the Gorgon image with the serpent goddess. And the serpent is how the Numa are often described by Olga Tamali, because they couldn't walk on land like humans do. They sort of, you know, slithered, I guess, like serpents. And they were also associated with the catfish. And they have drawings where they're depicted as fish with these catfish on the these whiskers on the lip, and we see this in old Europe. Maria Gimbutas talks about this with all the fat-bottomed figurines that appear in in the old goddess religion.
Yeah.
You know, some of them dating back 27,000 years ago. And this was a mystery to archaeologists because they refer to it as statopegia, where they have these fat legs and bottoms. Well, in the Dogon religion, it's you understand this because of the Numa were fish beings, and they were depicted as these big, you know, wide fish on some of the drawings. And in fact, when Dogon men, they refer to the men as wearing the man who had the most posture in the community had the widest pants, and the Hogan had the widest of all pants. You know, they'd be tight at the ankle, and they'd puff out into these really wide bottoms to mimic the Numo.
Fascinating.
So, yeah. So they were very much aquatic beings, and they had webbed hands. They didn't move very fast on land. They talk about them having this device that helped them travel. They referred to it as an iron sandal. And it emitted flames from it. So there were certain areas that couldn't be taken, and in those areas they would be carried on the backs of humans because they couldn't move very fast.
Huh, interesting. But do you think that they primarily, when they came to this planet, the Earth in that sense, they were in the oceans, yes, and now and then they maybe went up from there, or is it detailed in any regard of how, I mean, their ships, were they water-filled then, or?
I don't know. They don't really, they do mention that it was associated with a rainbow as it traveled through the sky, you know, that would almost suggest that it had water associated with it. In fact, you know, they were goddesses of water, and we see this also in Australia, where you have the rainbow serpent, and I talk about that in the book as well, because a lot of the myths from Aboriginal Australia are similar to some of the myths that the Dogon talk about, and so they don't really say, they just say that the ship was associated with a rainbow, and that the colors were shown when it traveled across the sky, and that it did look like a celestial ram.
Mm-hmm.
They also refer to it as being associated with wind. Had a lot of wind when it traveled. Excuse me.
Interesting. So, if we take the story of Uwanis, for instance, we have the same basic figure, if you will. There, the a serpent or a fish tail, and he were the bearers of wisdom, a number of, you know, things. He came out of the ocean, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that occurs to me, or one thing I'm wondering about in all of this, is the stories seem to have been told to the whole planet. All the cultures around the globe seems to have a very, very similar story when it comes to this. But the question is, do you think that it was the Dogon who actually had the real encounter, if you will, with them, and then this later on has been passed down to all the other cultures and told consequently, or is it actually a fact that all the cultures around the globe had a contact in one form or another with these beings? What do you think?
Well, that's a good question. I think that perhaps they have had contact with other cultures around the world too. The Dogon were the, I talk about mitochondrial Eve in the, in my book, because Lebe is considered the mother of all, humans existing today. And, we all came out of Africa at one time. I mean, geneticists have shown that. And, the mythology could have, traveled to different places of the world, from having been known in Africa. But at the same time, the Numo could have also traveled to other places of the world. And I believe that that may be possible, because the Dogon talk about the Numo, the sunlight bothered the Numo. So they liked to come out at night, and they lived underground. In fact, the spaceships were parked underground. So whenever the regeneration was occurring, you saw like Olga Tomelli said that in the beginning, humans had the ability to regenerate themselves. Excuse me. And they would go into the, they would be seen going into, down into the spaceship, which was parked under the ground. And the Dogon described this location as a giant anthill. So I talk about, Newgrange and places like that in Europe, because we see the same sort of concept appearing there with magical hills where the hero brings, usually is brought to this hill by a woman, and then they open the door and there's a queen in there who knows all the mysteries of the plant life and this kind of thing. So you see these same images appearing in Europe, and it's quite possible that, these hills that, you know, like Silbury Hill, mm-hmm. I think it's called, in mm-hmm. England, and that these were locations where their ships existed underneath. And
this is why these became hotspots, literally, then, in that sense.
And they talk about these teeth being around the entranceway, and you see this in the Maya mythology where Lord Pakal descends into the earth monster, you know, the teeth, it goes into the teeth of the earth monster each night and then ascends with the rising sun the following day. So, and you see this with the Pelagians, I think, they were born from the teeth of Ophion. And so these teeth are a very important symbol in the Dogon religion because they're at the entrance of the spaceship, and they're also associated with weaving. And weaving is a metaphor for the genetic inheritance of humanity being woven into humanity. And you have the symbol of cloth being a symbol of the word, which represents DNA in the Dogon religion.
Shannon, this religion could have been spread far and wide across Africa and then later into other continents as well, Europe, Asia, etc. But today, the Dogon are in Mali, primarily, you know, around northern Africa, to be crass. But what... do you think that they obviously, as you told us so far, they obviously came to this region because they were threatened because they wouldn't convert to Islam or maybe later or earlier to Christianity. So Right. Do we know where they originally were from?
Well, they mentioned that they came from Mandé, which was west of Bamako in Africa.
Is this far away from where they are today?
I don't think it's that far, no.
Interesting.
I'm not 100% sure how far it would be.
Yeah. So there might have been somewhere else, obviously, and so forth. But if we talk a little bit about, there's so many different avenues to explore here. Obviously, the whole story is fascinating, and there's many points that I want to get to. Why don't we talk a little bit more about Lebe and mitochondrial Eve, because this is some of the, you know, scientific evidence, if you will, then, that is being supporting the story, basically, in this case. And maybe, again, you can just run through for us how you think, then, that mankind as it exists today came to be. Is the mitochondrial Eve, is that the latest incarnation? Are we, if you will, then, descendants of this Lebe entity that they helped to create? Is that the story?
Yes, that's the story. That's what the Dogon people believed. And they hoped that over time humans would be able to regain their immortality, and that individuals like the jackal would not be left out of the world order as they describe it, because he had been severed from the Numos spiritual essence. So the importance of mitochondria DNA, or not DNA, but the mitochondria itself, is that it's only passed from mother to their offspring. And so this is how they're able to use this to determine, trace it back.
So obviously they have knowledge of DNA. And how is this today incorporated into the Dogon tradition? We have a whole interesting set of symbols and an alphabet, if you will, as well. Is this, can we see the science of this knowledge incorporated into this?
The Dogon people today, is that what
you... Yeah, exactly.
Most of my research deals with the record that was created by Marcel Griol, because I believe that after contact happened with the Europeans that you wouldn't have the purest form of the religion anymore, because you know, they were the French culture was a patriarchal culture at that time, so things would have been lost. So most of my research really deals with the period in the 1930s and 40s.
Right, have it unpolluted, so to speak, in that sense, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So I don't really know what is happening there today. I do plan to go there. It's very, there's a lot of violence there right now. A tourist was recently killed there, and I've heard that there's a lot of violence. So I wouldn't probably go there for a while, but
yeah.
And I would like to be bilingual, you know, be able to speak French well before I go there as well.
That's right. And it's a fairly popular tourist attraction, isn't it, these days, to go to Mali, this region?
Yes, it was, but I think it's, of late, it's been, people have been warned to stay away from there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Hmm.
I think a lot of the Al-Qaeda is there, and Al-Qaeda, and I think I read somewhere that Gaddafi's troops had fled there. And,
oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah, that's what... Yeah. So I don't know what's going on there.
By the way, as we look at some of the Dogon people, how they dress up and so forth today, and some of their the religious traditions comes through very much in the masks they wear. They have a certain set of clothes and so forth. They have even dances, as far as I understand it. Have you looked at of those aspects anything at all, Shannon?
Not to with what's going on today. Everything that I've studied is from what was recorded back in the 30s and 40s.
And that wasn't in regard in terms of these the dresses and the masks and everything else?
They do mention them in The Pale Fox, which was written, Germaine Dieterlen compiled a lot of that information, and some of Marcel Griol's research is in there as well. It was written after he died. But they do refer to some of those as well. I primarily focus on the mythology itself. And some of the dances they talk about, like sun dances and the dance of resurrection and this kind of thing relating to... the birth of Lebe.
That's right, and the primary story, is that coming from Hogan, the primary, the spiritual leader from the Dogon, right?
Yes, but he isn't the one that recorded it or told the religion to Marcel Griol. It was Ogotenali.
And he wasn't the Hogan at the time, or?
No. He was one of the elders, and he was chosen. He was a very intelligent man. They considered him one of the most intelligent men on the cliffs. And he was chosen by the Dogon elders to teach the religion, probably because he had he knew it well. He had learned it from his father and his grandfather. And he was also blind, which is an interesting point, because he wouldn't have been influenced by any changes that might have occurred in later days in the village. You know, everything he told Marcel Griol came from his memory, and I think that makes the record all the more significant as well.
Well, that's true, because it haven't been tainted, if you will, by the writing or the chance that it's been rewritten, has been the case so much throughout European and so forth history, that there's so much that have been polluted, if you will, in this way. So that's been a strategy. So the oral tradition is very important in that way. And if it's specifically, if it's been kept intact, but obviously we have so much more to discuss, and I want to continue talking about it in the next segment, Shannon. I want to discuss more about the Numo. I want to talk more about, obviously, where they came from originally, and also the knowledge that the Dogon has about Sirius B and even C later on discovered. This is a fascinating story. There's so much to that. But before we do that, though, let's talk a little bit more about your websites. Give out the titles of all your books. Obviously, the one we've been talking about here, well, we're talking about all of them, obviously, but your latest one is called The Day of the Fish, and then you also have The Numo out there and also The Master of Speech. Tell us about the websites you have out there as well, so people know where to go to pick up copies and to learn more about all of this, Shannon.
Yeah, so the websites are named after the books, so themasterspeech.com, thenumo.com, and dayofthefish.com are the names of the websites. And I also have my own website, shannondory.com, which is just, it's fairly new, so there isn't a lot of material on that. Most material probably appears on themasterofspeech.com.
The Master of Speech, excellent.com. We will have this linked up on redascreations.com, all the different websites, links to the books, of course, as well. By the way, have you made the cover, all the covers to the book? They're very similar.
Yes,
all
I
them.
Have.
Yeah, they look great, by the way. That's excellent.
Thank you.
And the fish theme, obviously, is there as well, and this is another aspect I want to talk more with you about in the next segment. But for now, then, stay with us, Shannon, and we'll continue in the next segment. We begin the second hour talking about the Numo's voyage from Sirius and the Pleiades. She tells us why the Venus transit is important to the Dogon. Shannon talks about how the Numo may feel morally obligated to help humanity and of the failed biological experiment that caused the birth of the male jackal that represents evil in the world. We talk about the Numos shape-shifting abilities, their androgyny, and the DNA they combined with Earth animals to create humans. She says Dogon religion connects human spirituality with the Earth itself. She believes the Dogon religion is important because it is so complex that anyone studying it can see that the truth has always existed there. Don't miss this interesting continuation with Shannon Dory. Go to redicecreations.com and log in if you're a member. If not, consider signing up for a membership. Just click on subscribe or members from any of our pages to get access and stream or download this or any of our previous programs. It's simple and it's easy. All the information is on the website. Next up on Red Ice Radio, we have Colin Andrews on government circles, crop circle research and 2012, Mac Maloney on UFOs in wartime, Troy McLaughlin on the Saturn death cult, Anthony Peake on out-of-body experiences. We also have Carl Munk, Jeff Hilling, Bob Frisell and Aquaria S. following these programs. We'll be back with more in just a few days. You're welcome to tune in then. But right now, coming up after this break, hour two, more on the new moon. Don't miss it.